Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. From Built It Productions, it's The Great Creators. Conversations about creativity with some of the most celebrated actors, musicians, and performers of our time. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, actor Justin Long, how he transformed from adorkable roles into one of Hollywood's best-known comedic actors, despite his early reservations.
I had no romantic notions of being an actor. I had no delusions of grandeur about it. If anything, it was like, you know, it's like the last thing I wanted to do for a long time.
Justin Long is probably best known for his roles in films like Accepted and Dodgeball. He was also in Apple's iconic Mac versus PC commercials. Justin played the hip Mac. Justin's voiced characters in animated films. He's written and directed his own films, and he's even got a podcast. He's actually an incredibly prolific and busy person. On this episode of The Great Creators, you'll find out how walking away from his first big paycheck actually led to Justin's first big break. You'll hear how a reference to Hamlet became central to the way he approaches roles, and how Justin's learned to create in the moment, be more present, and worry less about outcomes. And a story about how a life-threatening incident in Michigan changed the way he interacts with the public. That's all coming up after a quick break.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Justin Long's early life sounds a little bit like a movie. He grew up in a small college town in Connecticut, and even though his parents had totally different careers, they had a really solid but somewhat quirky marriage and home life. His mom was a stage actress performing in local theater and commuting to New York City for auditions. His father was a professor at Fairfield University and a world-renowned expert in medieval philosophy.
He was always so interesting growing up. I mean, I loved talking to him. You know, we'd have great family conversations, and he was just very, very open to different schools of thought. And we grew up Catholic, but he loved talking about other religions and other ideas. And he just loved thinking.
Yeah,
he's a real thinker.
And your mom was an actor, a stage actor.
Yes, so she was an actress, and it was an interesting balance that they struck sometimes, where she was, you know, outwardly more, she's certainly more gregarious, and socially she would do more of the heavy lifting. And my dad was very funny, but in a dry kind of more sardonic, you know, more. Just not as performative. My mom was a real actor, like wanted to be, you know, Sally Field or Mary Tyler Moore. Looked up to actresses like that, and a really good actress, really great stage actress. I have memories of seeing her in like Blythe Spirit and Noel Coward plays. She was really good with plays like that, and very alive on stage. And so we kind of grew up in that environment. We grew up going to a lot of theater, and most of her friends were in the theater community. And
she did mainly local theater?
Local theater, mostly. Every once in a while, she'd get a commercial, like an on-camera commercial, and it would... It would feel like, you know, she'd won the lottery. I remember the exuberance. But I also remember all of the, you know, I had no romantic notions of being an actor. I had no delusions of grandeur about it. If anything, it was like, you know, it's like the last thing I wanted to do for a long time. Because I saw the reality of it. And she was a working actress, but with three kids, you know, and approaching her 40s, it's not the easiest life. And I saw all of that because we weren't really in a position where we had nannies or anything. So we would often, if she had an audition in New York, we lived about an hour and a half from the city. She would have to, she would say the word schlep. She'd schlep us around. And there was a lot of tension and stress and other adults being kind of mean to her. The way the casting directors would talk to her, the agents, really belittling. So I had no interest in doing that. It was the last thing I wanted to do, was to be in that world.
Because you had seen just
I saw the reality of it.
Yeah, the endless rejections. Yeah. But even seeing your mom go through all of that, I mean, you did eventually gravitate towards acting in high school, right?
Yeah, I remember Guy doing a play, and it was a Neil Simon play called Biloxi Blues, and I've told this before, but it sounds, I hope it doesn't sound too pretentious. I was doing a scene. I played a character named Arnold Epstein who was getting bullied. He was getting picked on, and he has a monologue where he talks about cleaning the latrines and getting, you know, abused by one of the other soldiers. And for whatever reason, I really connected with this moment in the play, and I came off stage afterwards, and you know, the kids would always say, how's the audience? You know, what are people liking it? You know, you'd always kind of have an awareness when I was younger, I had an awareness of the audience and if there were, who was in there, who was out there, and if we could see any of your friends. And they said, how was it? You know, how'd it go? And I realized I couldn't answer them. I had no idea. I felt like I had had this, not as supernatural as like an out of body experience, but I felt I had been so immersive that, I had no awareness of anything else, but what I was saying to the other actor. And so it was a really thrilling moment. I remember realizing that there was that potential to really lose yourself in something on stage and to feel. And since then, I've always felt like a real safety, I guess, between whether I'm on stage or between action and cut. You know, there's a freedom in getting to express yourself, even though you're often using other people's words.
This was in high school when you were in Blood.
Yeah. I didn't come to all of this in high school. Yeah. It was in high school. And so I still, in high school, it was still such a pipe dream. If ever I harbored, you know, ideas about being a professional actor, I didn't share them with anybody. I went to college then and I was going to pursue a philosophy degree because that's where the money is, Guy. And I was doing so many plays in high school, in college rather, that it's all I really cared about. And I did a play with an actress named Angela Goethals, who was so talented, and she had been a professional actress before she went to college. She had a little part in Jerry Maguire. Wow. She was the gymnast who's on the phone with him in the beginning. Oh, Jerry! You know, and Bob Sugar's trying to poach her. So it was a thrill just to like have seen her in something. And then I was doing this David Mamet play with her, and it was a two-person play called Oleana. And I just remember Angela saying to me, you know, I think I was talking to her about it. I think she probably got the sense that I was curious about what it was like to be professional. And so for whatever reason, she encouraged me she said, well, you should try it. I don't know. The encouragement from somebody like that meant a lot, because I felt like, and I felt like we were kind of going toe to toe with one another in this play. And it just gave me a lot of confidence, you know, to get out there and try it. And so I did. The next semester, I deferred my enrollment.
I'm curious about your first kind of, I don't know if it was break, but maybe it was like lucky experience was you auditioned to take over for Steven, the character Steven on Blue's Clues. And
yes.
I guess he was in like contract negotiations and it wasn't clear whether he was going to continue. And I thought, I didn't know that about you, but like you would have been a perfect Blue's Clues. You would have been absolutely perfect for that. So what happened? How did you tell me the story about that?
Well, so they had in New York, they would have, they still do, I suppose. They have, they call them cattle calls.
Yeah.
You can go in, anybody can go in without, you don't need an agent.
Yeah. And you were like 20 or something at the time.
I was 20. Yeah. I was 19 maybe, yeah. 20. But I sent in, I had headshots that were like from Kmart or wherever. And literally, I still have them. I just saw them at my house the other day. They're really embarrassing now. But I thought they were like, oh, this is going to work.
Yeah.
This is professional. And so I took them to, I sent them to all the agents and a little, I padded my resume, of course. It was like the Poughkeepsie Dinner Theater instead of just like Vassar College.
Right.
It was Vassar College.
Right.
But it was like Poughkeepsie Regional, whatever. And so I thought, well, this is going to work. And I sent it to all of the, back then you'd look and there was this book called Backstage and or the Ross Reports, and you look and you find out where all the agencies are. And I sent all of my stuff and I never heard back. And so I started going into auditions that accepted anybody, even people who weren't in the unions without an agent. And anyone can do this. New York plays all have a day, or they did anyway, where anybody could come in and audition. So I did that for Blue's Clues. And, you know, the first audition, they treat you like there are a lot of people that they have to see, just like a lot of people to get through, and kind of rude. And then they called me back the next day, and they're slightly nicer, and there are fewer people. And and then they brought me in several times. And then I didn't hear from them for long enough that I just assumed I hadn't gotten it. And I was about to start up the second semester. And it was the day before the second semester began, I got a call saying, we want to offer you a holding deal. It was a holding contract, which meant that, and I said, well, I didn't know this at the time. I said, well, what does that mean? They said, well, it just means you, for 3 months, you can't audition for anything else. And we're going to pay you $15,000 for those 3 months, which,
wow.
You know, I was delivering pizzas, guy. Yeah. I was like, I had no money. My parents were very kind, but they were like, you know, look, if this is something you want to do, you're on your own.
Yeah.
And, as it was, I was on financial aid. So I had an on-campus job to make up that financial aid and to pay for my trips into the city to audition. I was delivering pizzas and stuff. So I was $15,000 for 3 months was like
unbelievable. In 1998,
I can retire.
That's crazy.
Yes, that's it.
Crazy money.
Crazy. And,
yeah.
For doing nothing, literally, it's all, they were paying me to not do something.
Audition. Right.
Yes, which I couldn't do anyway because I didn't have an agent, because none of the agents had called me from my, like, this headshot. So it was perfect. And I thought, well, man, it's smooth sailing now. And I called up and they said, oh, there's the catch is you need a lawyer, or you need, just have your agent negotiate, you know, they had to. And I said, well, I don't have an agent. Well, get a lawyer, somebody. So I called up all the agents that I'd sent my stuff to, and I said, hi, I'm an actor, and I go to school, and, you know, I'm 20. Yeah, okay, send your picture and resume. Sorry, I did that. I did that several months ago, but we'll get back to you, you know. And I said, but sorry, I just need help with the contract. That's all I need is like one. And of course, as soon as they hear that, yeah.
Because they're going to get 10% off that.
yes, no matter what. Hold on 1 second. That's a, you know, $1,500 phone call. So a lot of the agents, some of them said, we don't want to represent you regardless. Some said, you know, come in for a meeting. So I had a couple meetings from that. And it's funny, guy, I remember one said, we just signed a guy. Unfortunately, we just signed somebody like you, and they called him Jake Geilinghall. And which now would be very, very insulting to Jake if he hears this. He's like, I'm nothing like him. I'm flattered by that. But so they didn't sign me. But somebody did, a very sweet woman named Kristen Barbara, innovative artist, who's soon after left to be a kindergarten teacher, which shows you how ill-equipped she was to be an agent.
But Blue's Clues, perfect.
I know,
kind of,
it
yeah,
was.
Right.
So she said, well, you know, I'll represent you. And then I had to struggle with whether or not to sign this thing, because having an agent at that age and knowing what my mother had gone through, having a good agent was like, you know, it was hard to turn my nose at that, and it was hard to not take advantage of that. So I didn't sign the
holding contract. You didn't take the money.
I didn't take the money because I wanted to audition. I wanted to see what was out there. I was, you know, I'm sure now, I hate to say this, I'd take the money. But I had such enthusiasm, you know, this, you know, I was 20. I wanted to just get out in the world and just jump in. And fortunately, within that 3 months, I got an audition for a small show called Stuckeyville at the time. It later became Ed. And it didn't get picked up, but it was a two-line part for like student number two or something in the classroom. And I had
and
to
it was
basically
just like in New York City, there was just like a casting, like a cattle call, and you just showed up.
Well, this was a little bit more targeted because now I had an agent.
Right. And they were looking for now, a certain type. They were looking for like a high school kid.
High school, nerdy, neurotic. And I was like, and guy, I was so nervous to be in these rooms as it was that there was something very natural about, I just kind of leaned into the nerves, you know, and the sister of the casting director was casting Galaxy Quest. And so that's how I got that audition.
So she saw you and said, oh, and told her sister about you.
She saw me and said to her sister, you know, I think this kid might, you might want to see him.
Because Galaxy Quest is a science fiction spoof, kind of sort of satirizing Trekkies. And they were looking for like a lovable kind of dorky nerd.
Yes, somebody very committed. That character was very, you know, and kind of nervous and shaky, but yeah. And so that's how I was. That was my mental state going into that audition because I was so nervous for that one in particular because I don't think I had read for any movies. And I remember in the waiting room seeing actors that I recognized.
Like who?
You know, like I remember seeing Eddie K. Thomas and Kieran Culkin and I was like, these are movie stars. And I was in love with movies. And so I knew all the actors and stuff. And I just figured I'm out of my league. I'm out of my element. And so it made me that much more uncomfortable, which in a weird way helped, I think, the character.
You got that part, of course, for Galaxy Quest. We know you were in that film. When you found out you got that role, I mean, you were going to be in a movie with, this is your first movie ever, with Sigourney Weaver, Alan Rickman, Sam Rockwell.
It was crazy.
The greatest actors of their
It was wild. It was, I don't think I'd ever been on a plane. I think maybe once before to Florida, but they flew me to LA and they were already shooting when I flew out there to do like a screen test. And God, I'd never been to LA. I had never been on a lot. And it was one of those movie sets that it was very much like you'd imagine growing up in a small town, like you'd imagine what Hollywood looks like, you know, because there were aliens and there were, you know, people in like crazy costumes smoking
golf
cigarettes
carts everywhere.
Exactly. It was like Who Framed Roger Rabbit without all the, but it was, and I was, my mind was blown. I was, and I remember they were shooting. They took me, they told me I had it after I read, and they brought me back into the room, and it was, I still remember the feeling. It was just all so overwhelming. And then they took me to the set and they were shooting that day. I remember they were shooting the stuff where Tim Allen and Sigourney have, they're on the little communicator. And I thought it was so strange that they were doing a scene that I would then shoot a month later. They were supposed to be talking to my character in the scene. And that was so strange to me because I had only done theater. And I thought, well, is there another actor playing me now? You know, it was all so foreign to me. But it was, I was a huge fan of all those actors. Ironically, I didn't know Sam's work at the time. And Sam Rockwell was the guy who was probably closest to me in age. And so it really took me under his wing. And, you know, I didn't know anyone in LA and he would, he'd let me hang out with him and he'd take me around and show me LA. And so he became my friend on that. And then a year later, we did a play together. And during that year, I watched all of the movies I could find that he was in. I watched Lawn Dogs and Box of Moonlight and all of these great 90s indie movies. And I became like a fan of his, you know, in the interim.
So once you got that role in that film, that was it. That was basically it. You were now firmly going to be in LA. That was what you were thinking.
Well, That's what I thought, Guy. And then, yeah, I thought so. And toward the end of that shoot, I auditioned for a summer camp movie that was like an ensemble summer camp movie that was written by the guy who wrote Heathers. So I thought, well, that's it. That's now, it's just going to be one after another, you know. And then the reality of the business and how kind of unpredictable it is kind of starts to set in. And that pilot that I had done, who, you know, who's the casting director whose sister saw me, that pilot then got picked up a year later, and it was called Ed. And then they offered me a reoccurring part, and it shot in New York. And so I actually moved back home. I moved back to Connecticut to do that. So, you know, I had these, I thought I'd be off to the races, you know, and then I found myself back living in my parents' house, commuting over the Tappan Zee Bridge to New Jersey to shoot a show that I am so glad I did. I mean, I loved doing it. It was like going to acting school too, because I on camera acting school, because I, like I said, I had no real experience, and I got to play a smaller part and do a lot of observing, you know, and I got to work with actors who were really seasoned, and Tom Cavanaugh and Julie Bowen and people like that. Tim Busfield, I learned so much from those people. So it was the best, you know, 3-4 years and a show that not a lot of people saw. So it was like, I got to do a lot of wild stuff, a lot of really funny. I felt really comfortable. I felt really like to take chances, because not a lot of people were watching. The network wasn't breathing down, you know, it was just kind of like a show that was left alone. And so I got to experiment and do some really fun stuff.
When we come back in just a moment, how those early acting experiences taught Justin to commit to all his roles as if they were Hamlet, and how he once committed so hard, he ended up with heat exhaustion. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. So it's the turn of the millennium, and Justin Long had landed a role in Galaxy Quest and started shooting a sitcom in New York, again as the nerdy guy. But then he began to get other roles, even a romantic lead, almost in spite of himself.
What's so interesting to me about your career, and particularly early in your career, is that you seem to have made a very smart and conscious strategic decision. Maybe strategic is not the right word, but you were, you know, your early roles were these sort of typecast characters, kind of lanky, lovable, geeky, nerdy, you know, sort of young guy. And both in Galaxy Quest and in Ed. In Ed, you played Warren. And you started to get, you know, you started to get offers to be in films. And pretty early on, you did some parts that were very different. I mean, you did Jeepers Creepers as a horror film, and you were in Herbie, in the Herbie film, Herbie Fully Loaded, as like a romantic sort of love interest. Did you sort of think that through? I mean, did you have conversations with your agent or with other people?
No, I wish I had, Guy. No, I was laughing when you said strategy, strategic, because no, it was really just what I, in fact, I wish I'd been a little bit better about that. A little bit more conscientious of what the next move was. Because when you're at a certain point, a lot of things were coming at me and I had a lot of really exciting opportunities. And Jeepers Creepers, for example, was just, it was something I got in front. I auditioned and got it. And I got
Francis Ford Coppola was part of that. I was attached to that.
Coppola produced it, and I got to have dinner with him the first night.
At his house up in Napa, or?
No, he came to Florida where we were shooting. I wish. But I remember he just wanted to, see, now I would want to talk to him about this stuff. At the time, he wanted to talk about pasta and cooking.
And he's a great cook. Yeah.
Great, and he was very passionate about it. He was talking about his bolognese, and I now, having recently become passionate about cooking, I wish I could go back and have that conversation. I wish I could have him on Life is Short and talk to him all about cooking, because he seems so passionate. But I just wanted to know about, I was such a film nerd, I wanted to know about, you know, the scene where Martin Sheen has a breakdown in Apocalypse Now, and he did. He told me some great stories. He told me a good one about that, but it was exciting to be the lead of a movie. And I remember before I did it, I was doing this play, as I mentioned, with Sam, with Rockwell. Mm-hmm. And Sam was going off to do, he was about to do a David Mamet movie called Heist. And he said, hey, would you mind? It really meant a lot to me. I thought it was really exciting. And he said, would you mind running lines with me? Mm-hmm. And so I did. And you know, there were these great David Mamet lines, like, I don't want you to be as quiet as a mouse pissing on cotton. I want you to be as quiet as a mouse not even thinking about pissing on cotton. You know, the lines that were like, what? It's so good. And then he said, well, and I had mentioned I was doing a movie too. And he said, well, let's run your lines, you know, let's do yours. And I was so, I think he saw how self-conscious I was about it, because they were like, you know, horror movie lines. They were like, we got to get out of here, you know, or whatever. It wasn't David Mamet. And so I felt a little self-conscious, and he said, hey, man, I'll never forget this. He said, you got to treat this like it's your Hamlet. You got to treat it like it's your Hamlet. And it was a really good lesson. The lesson was to just, you know, invest in it as you would anything else and commit to it. Even though it was, you know, it was what it was. It was a B horror movie. And I never forgot that advice, to not have pretensions about, oh, like how lofty a thing is, that it's a job, it's a part, and you commit.
I interviewed Jimmy Fallon once, and you actually reminded me of him a lot. And he used to film his stand-up routines and then watch them and critique them. And it struck me as amazing, because it's so hard to do. You know, a lot of people in my profession, and I've been in broadcasting for 25 years, it took me a long time to hear myself after the fact. Were you able to, would you watch yourself and your performances on screen after they were, you know, out there and sort of, or would you avoid doing that?
No, it wasn't until a couple of years later that I had a hard time watching certain, when I think I got a little more comfortable as an actor, it was harder for me to watch. But I certainly wouldn't watch to see what I did right or wrong. I wouldn't watch with that intention. I can see, it's funny you mentioned Jimmy, because I'm picturing Jimmy doing that. And it always strikes me that he has mannerisms that are similar to late night hosts, that like Johnny Carson, he's Dave Letterman. There are certain guys that you pull from. And what I did notice with myself was I could pinpoint certain gestures or mannerisms that I was pulling from, that I was like, you know, really just robbing from, you know, stealing from, for lack of a better word. And I saw a lot of, you know, just guys that I watched growing up that I idolized. You know, if it was Michael J. Fox, I saw a lot of like this. Doc, are you telling, you know, are you telling me there was that? I still do it when I'm talking.
Yeah.
I use my hands this way, and I can directly link it to him. Or I watched a lot of Woody Allen when I was a kid. And I started seeing people in performances, but it wasn't to the point where I was like, I have to stop doing that, or I should alter it based on that. I think I would, that would put me too much in my head. And I think the reason why those early performances are hard for me was because, as it was, I was already in my head more than I should be.
I think that is a very common characteristic of anyone, you know, who is performing in a sense early in their career, you know, that it's sort of what you do is a bit of a pastiche of your idols. I mean, that's very normal because you don't know what your identity is yet. You're 20, 21, 22. You don't know who you are.
That's true.
You mentioned Michael J. Fox. I know you loved Matthew Broderick. You loved
Yeah. I loved Matthew Broderick, and it's still Ferris Bueller, I think, is one of the great performances.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've really looked up to those guys, and in fact, I was fired from a movie. You know, everyone has that, or you're supposed to have that story where you were fired from a job. An animated movie called Tale of Despero. I was so thrilled to have been offered.
Yes,
and it was to talk about a cast that, like, there's my favorite actor, Stanley Tucci, and Dustin Hoffman, and I think Sigourney was in that as well. And it was like just all these actors I admired, and Gary Ross, the director, was shooting. He was having the actors interact, which is unusual for an animated movie. Usually, and he was body miking and booming everybody. So I got to really like interact with them. Obviously, I love Back to the Future, and I got to do a scene with Christopher Lloyd, and it was really fun. He said as they were animating. Because I asked him if he wanted me to pitch, you know, you want me to go up a little bit? Because I'm playing a 12-year-old mouse who wants to be a knight. And so I thought, you know, and he said, no. It probably sounded ridiculous. He said, I just want your voice, you know. And the reason they gave was because he said, your voice, as we were animating to the it was just too deep. You know, because I did several sessions and so I was hurt, but I had hoped that was the real reason, and then I found out that they replaced me with Matthew Broderick, which was weirdly flattering. But guy, it was flattering to me. I was like, well, good. If it's, you know, it's like it's somebody I really admire, somebody I look up to, got the job, and then a month later, I got the Alvin and the Chipmunks job, and I remember seeing Gary months later, and he of course felt bad. Gary's a really nice guy, and he said, hey, how you doing? I said, well, good, and I was so happy that I could tell him. I said, you know, I'm still. I know you fired me as the rodent, but I'm now a chipmunk. Like, went from my voice is too low for a mouse, maybe, but I am now a chipmunk. So yeah. It had a happy ending.
Right, because you played Alvin in Alvin and the Chipmunks. Yeah. But by the way, did you ever meet Ross Bagdasarian Jr. and his wife Janice, who run the chipmunk empire now?
Oh, sure. Oh, they were in almost every recording session. And the interesting thing about that job, guy, was that, you know, because they used obviously computers to speed it, they sped everything up.
Just tell me how you recorded it. What does it sound like when you record it?
It's like this. It's you know, the difficulty was in getting like things like, because Alvin's very sarcastic, and so that was always the challenge, was getting timing, was getting comedic timing, because you have to say everything like this, and it helps to really highlight the.
The cadence, the pitch, the tonality.
So really you have to do it like kind of like a bad actor. You have to do it like over the top. So it'd be like, oh, right, Theodore, I'm the one who left the toilet seat down. You know, whatever. That's obviously not one of the lines. I don't think he could lift the toilet seat. It's a bad improv. Ross, you mentioned, it always made me laugh because Ross Bagdasarian kind of speaks like that naturally.
Yeah.
He's not boring, but he has a very pronounced way of talking like that. And I always wondered if it was just from years of recording that. Because he did the animated show, which I watched as a kid. I mean, talk about.
And he was also, you know, Dave.
He was Dave.
He sounds like Dave in real life.
Dave, yeah, Alvin, yeah, yeah. It was fun. It was a thrill, and I still dine out on it when I meet kids. You know, when like kids who are totally nonplussed by my presence, as they should be. The parents will say, you know, he's, you know, they'll try to impress them with Alvin, and they're always a little if they're young enough, they're like thrown and it's like, doesn't make sense. And I tell the parents not to say that because you're ruining a really special thing.
Did you feel, I mean, you know, as you know, having worked in Hollywood for so long, and I think you've got like 115 film credits, something crazy. It's too many to talk about on this show. But as you know, it's the same, very similar in professional sports, which is a lot of actors are children or grandchildren of actors and have grown up in Hollywood, because it's like with sports, you know, there's like a sports, so-called sports gene. There's probably a so-called acting gene. So many actors who are great actors, you know, are the children or grandchildren of great actors. Mm. You weren't. I mean, well, your mom was an actor, but you were not a Hollywood actor. You were sort of an outsider, but all of a sudden you were in these films with people that you had seen on screen, that you and really famous young actors, Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears. I mean, did you feel like you were an outsider, particularly early in your career?
Yeah, I suppose so. I certainly didn't feel like I was part of this. I wasn't part of the scene or anything, you know, in LA. Yeah. It wasn't like, I remember going, in fact, with Lindsay to get to know her. We were hanging out a little bit. She invited me somewhere. And I remember going, and she was deep in that world, in that scene. And
yeah, she was so super famous, like on this part, like in Us Weekly all the time. Yeah.
And so I remember being quite uncomfortable. And in that car, we were all in a car, we were all in a big Escalade. And I remember sitting next to somebody in the car and I said, what do you do? And she said, well, Lindsay's like sidekick. And remember those things? They were little, like phones, I guess, little text, a way to text and stuff. They were called sidekicks. And I said, yeah. She said, you know how it's like, have you seen it? And I said, yeah. Oh, it's got like jewels on it. It's like bejeweled. It's like that. And I said, yeah. And she goes, well, I do that. So I never knew that could be a job, to bejewel a sidekick. It was that kind of stuff was like wild to me. And I'm sure there were moments where I got too, you know, into that, or I was removed from who my friends. Yeah. But I was really lucky to have family too. And my brother, we've always been very close. My brother always, and my friends always kind of ensured that I had my feet on the ground as much on the ground as, you know, as I could, even during all the crazy years.
It's always interesting to hear about, you know, the early lives of people who you recognize, whether they're athletes or people on screen or people that have had some kind of cultural impact, because oftentimes they knew each other before they were.
Yeah.
Like you lived with Jonah Hill, like before he had you know, success as an actor. You guys were roommates, which is normal. I mean, these stories of, you know, roommates.
Yeah,
And you would eventually be in at least one film together.
Oh, we did four. More. We did several. We did, Jonah was, I met him on a show called Campus Ladies that was sort of like, it was an all improv style. And right away I was struck by how brilliant he was. I hadn't really met anybody that, you know, that quick and just so funny. And I had the opportunity to play, it was my first like studio, whatever. It was just a big chance to do a Universal movie. So there's a lot of pressure. It was the lead of this movie and they needed the part of my best friend, and the script was not quite.
This is the film
Accepted. It was, and
it was like a comedy about getting into college getting into college, starting your own college.
Exactly, yeah.
A fake college,
To trick his parents.
And he was the kid who got into the college.
Yes. So, well, he makes his own college, kind of. It's a movie, I've been hearing about it lately because I think it's on Netflix now. But I called up the casting director. I said, you got to see this guy. And so Jonah came in and read for the casting director. And then they said, well, you know, he's just not quite... I don't know if he's quite right for it. And I was flabbergasted because I was like this. And the whole thing was like they wanted people who could improvise because the script wasn't totally there yet and was still being like worked on. And It was during a time where, like, you know, Vince Vaughn, Owen Wilson movies, those guys, I think the studios were starting to recognize that they were doing a lot of improv, and it was making these movies better, and Knocked Up and the Judd Apatow movies, of course, so much of that is improv. And so they wanted somebody who could do that. And I said, I can't believe this guy is gold. I mean, this guy is so good. And so I called the head of the studio and said, I went over this person's head, and I said, you gotta bring Jonah in for the screen test. And she did. Donna, she was smart. And after he read, of course, everybody in the room, except for the casting director who had left, everybody was like, oh, this is the guy.
Wow. You know, I wonder, because you had not come from the world of improv, right? Like, you had been trained yourself in theater and stage, and you obviously had these comedic roles, and comedy became this sort of central part of what you did. Obviously, huge role in Dodgeball, which was a massive film, a huge, massive success. And while you were already pretty well known, is it fair to say that film really kind of changed the trajectory of your career?
Yeah, Guy, I think so. It was, I had mentioned that show, Ed, and like I said, those guys were allowing me to do a lot of improv. I felt like a real freedom there. So I did this episode of where I join a wrestling team. I try to join the wrestling team to impress a girl. So I was doing a lot of physical stuff, a lot of, I was doing backflips. I remember I fell on my head once, and I didn't want to embarrass myself because I was trying to make people laugh, and I just got up, but I'm sure I was concussed. I was just throwing my body around and just being wild. And the writer director of Dodgeball saw that episode, and he wrote the part for me.
And the character's name is Justin.
Yeah, so that's why. And had it not been for that, and the studio wanted, they thought I was too old, and the producers wanted other actors, and so it was something that. I remember doing the table read of it, and I was, God, you know, talk about comedy heroes, Vince Vaughn and Ben Stiller were two of the best, you know, my biggest. And after the read through, I think they were talking about casting somebody else. And so I'm so grateful to Ross and the writer, the director, who just fought for me on that. And because the truth is, I was way too old for that part. I was 24. And it was written for a 15-year-old. The kid was in, you know, sophomore, junior in high school. And so I'm so eternally grateful to him. And that's when things kind of started to change. And that's when Stiller and Vince kind of took me under their wing and got me in with their agent. And, you know, Vince started hiring me for other stuff. And we became pals. And it was, it was just a really magical time. It was a really wonderful time.
I'm curious about how you sort of become those characters. I mean, you know, let's talk about your character and Accepted. And it's, I'm just picking that character out because there's a scene where, like, he, you know, there's a musical number, right? He's like singing Blitzkrieg Bop, right, in that film?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, my God. I was like...
There's like a scene where he's like jumping around. And,
yeah, that was funny, Guy.
And so...
Yeah. You mentioned Matthew Broderick. I watched Ferris Bueller. I watched performances that I thought were just, this guy had to be really charming, and he just had to be very likable, even despite the unlikable things he was doing. I mean, he was deceiving a lot of people, and and I tried to keep it as light as possible. I remember committing to that as best I could, and I remember it being like a really big opportunity. The Blitzkrieg Bop scene was funny because I kind of overcommitted to that because I was so excited to have this moment. It was like the Ferris Bueller moment where he sings the Beatles, Twist and Shout, and, you know, during the parade. And so I really wanted to go for it. And also there was a thrill of getting to be like a rock star. You know, everybody has a fantasy of being like on stage singing a Ramone. And it was the Ramones. And it was one it was kind of in my wheelhouse. I have a very limited range, but I was like, I can do this. And all these like, you know, actresses I wanted to impress were there. You know, all these people were watching. It was this big crowd scene. And I went so crazy during that first, it was rehearsal. And that by the end, I didn't realize how much energy it took to really do that, to commit to being a rock star. One song, I came off stage and I thought I was going to pass out. I had heat stroke, heat exhaust, whatever I had, I was exhausted. And the hair and makeup ladies had to bring me Pedialyte in a straw and little fans, you know, and I almost passed out. And they hadn't shot it.
Wow.
It was so embarrassing. And I remember director, he was Steve Pink. He said, do you want to try that again? And I said, well, I might need a couple minutes. So they had to piece together. I think I could only get through like two or three takes of that before I was like, I can't do anymore. And whenever I watch that movie, whenever I see that part, all I can see is my exhaustion.
When we come back in just a moment, Justin becomes the recognizable face of Apple computers. And that recognition makes him the target of a kidnapping in Michigan. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. Okay, so it's the mid-2000s, and Apple is about to unveil its now iconic MacBook laptop. They asked Justin if he'd be willing to do a commercial to promote Apple computers. At the time, there was still a stigma around celebrities doing endorsements, so Justin had to make a tough decision.
I know it sounds crazy to say now because it was such a good thing in my life, but it was... It wasn't an easy decision. And I think the appeal was, the most flattering part was that Steve Jobs had seen, I think it was accepted, in fact. He had seen something that he felt like I reminded.
I read it was a Herbie. He saw Herbie with his daughter, and he liked it.
It was a Herbie. Wow. I had heard that I reminded him of a younger version of himself or something like that. There was some... not my brain, but just aesthetically. I wish it was more than that. I was like, wow, Steve Jobs, obviously one of the great innovators. And they told me what the setup was, which was appealing. And so I thought, wow, that'll be really fun. So we were just going to do like a couple days of it, just a one-off. It was meant to be a one-off thing. And it was John Hodgman, who I immediately fell in love with. And we just hit it off so instantly. And that was the big appeal of that campaign for me. It was getting to just play with John on that white background, and in between shots we would talk. I mean, it was before, you know, the irony is it was before people had cell phones, had the iPhone.
It's crazy, I know. But those ads, totally iconic, won tons of awards, and were, you know, They were warm and a little bit, it was a little bit of a dig, obviously, at PCs, but also warm. And you loved the John Hodgman character. And your character, what's interesting about your character in those, because you did like 30 or 40, I mean, tons of these short spots over a four-year period, was that you were not the nerdy, geeky, you were like, not like the high school jock. You were the likable, creative, you know, the kind of person that if you were watching that ad, many people say, oh, I want to be like that guy. You became a, it was almost like you, that was a somewhat of a different role. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, it was. It was not one that I had been asked to do, really. He was laid back. He was confident. He was more of a neutral character. The challenge, though, Guy, was that those ads are inherently arrogant. The point is that I'm better. I'm the embodiment of something that is better than this other person. And so how, that was always the challenge, was how to convey that without sounding, without being overtly arrogant.
Elitist, yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, I remember them wanting me to say, when I say, hello, I'm a Mac, they wanted me to be very proud of that, you know. Say it like that. That was the note that it wasn't Phil Morrison, the director. Phil got what I was doing. It was the executives, the Apple executives. They kept coming up to him and whispering in his ear. And Phil would like begrudgingly give me the note, Justin, could you do it, you know, just a little bit more proud? And I was so self-conscious about being a pitch man, you know, being like, hey, I'm the guy who's selling you this. So they wanted, hello, I'm a Mac. Really, like, this is who I am. I'm proud. And I thought, God, we have to, like, as much as we can, stay off, like, lean the other direction. So I tried to be more casual, and I just didn't. And I've never done this before, just not followed a note. It's not a good lesson to, like, teach kids, but because I love giving myself over to directors, you know, and I love the idea of being a vessel for whatever. But there was something about this that I thought, because Phil kept saying, just give them one. They just want one. And I knew if they had one, that they would use it. So that is the one thing I'm proud of, is that I ignored my superior's direction.
Yeah. I mean, it was such a visible campaign, and you know, you and John Hodgman both were sort of, you know, in a sense associated with this. But did it ever at a certain point, I don't know, bother you with people coming up to you saying, hey, look, I just bought a Mac, or coming, you know, I don't know.
That never bothered me. I always found that funny because they vacillated between being occasionally annoying, depending on how the person did it, and very funny, you know, and nice. And oftentimes it was nice. But it was the funniest part of it to me was that I know nothing of, and anyone who knows me will corroborate this, I'm really bad with computers. And so sometimes people would come up to me and say, hey, I just really quick, they say it casually too, like really quick, I'm sorry, I've been hitting control alt delete and I've noticed like a thing on the top of my browser. Like, I'm sorry, what are you talking about? So those were always funny to me and to my friends, to my brother, he would laugh at that stuff. Yeah. I remember somebody across the street, I was in New York, they just said, hey, they pointed at me and they said, hey, I got a computer. And they didn't know what else to say. They just, get you. And going into the Apple store was always funny because it was, because they'd always, because I would shop there because, you know, I had, I liked the products. And, but they would always look at me like there would be like a mixture of,
is this real?
Yeah.
Is this like, did Apple send
it? And there was always, one of the colors in their face was always annoyance. There was always a little bit of annoyance. There was always a shade of annoyance because they had to play those ads all day on a loop in those stores. And so it was like, oh, that's kind of cool, but like, I don't want to look at you anymore than I have already, you know. But it changed a lot. Yeah, it did change a lot.
Yeah. And clearly that, you know, this reputation you had as a sort of a computer savant maybe contributed to your role as a white hat hacker.
Well, it did.
And Live Free or Die Hard.
It did, funny enough. That Bruce Willis's kids, I think they showed him Accepted. So it was that movie, but it was all Bruce knew me from those ads. Yeah. And I think that was part of it. I think I had this, because I was seen in this light in this tech savvy way, I think it did. I think it helped me get that job, which then led to other great jobs. So, you know, all of the people have asked me, like, well, do you think it hurt your career? What effect do you think it had on your career? And it is a different time. I think had I done those now, it would have had zero effect, or if anything, it would have just been a positive thing. But it was a time where there was that stigma about actors doing commercials.
Yeah. You kind of jump back into theater I think around 2011, 2012 in a play with, it was with Jeff Goldblum, back on Broadway's Seminar. You are now on stage again, a dramatic role. I know you've done some stage. Help me understand, like, when you are on stage, it's a different performance, right? Because when you are on a set in front of a camera, you have to basically leap out of that camera, right? In a sense that you there's a different way of communicating with the camera than when you're communicating with an audience.
Yes. When I started, though, Guy, I was so used to being on stage, and everything I knew about acting was stage-oriented. I wanted to deny that the camera was there, that anybody was around. I just wanted to be as insular as possible, which I've since adopted a different attitude about. I think now I have enough of an awareness about the technical side of it. Whereas on stage, it's just, you're just present. There's something, because of that, I think there's something a little bit more pure about it, about just having this lived experience all at the same time. The chronology is different. It's easier to be totally immersive, if that makes sense.
Yeah. One of the things that you've done and continue to do is to write screenplays and with your brother.
Yes, Christian.
You had a film that came out, I think, a year and a half ago, Lady of the Manor. And of course, you wrote A Case of You a few years ago, also with your brother. Tell me a little bit about that process, because it's a completely different part of your brain that you're working with.
It's funny you say that, because I had been using, I felt like, I think the impetus to do it was because I had been using that part of my brain on a lot of the jobs, on jobs like Accepted or Die Hard. There was so much, it went beyond.
How would you do it? How would you do it?
Well, we would rewrite a lot of that stuff. Like, for example, in Accepted, that last speech hadn't been written until the day we got to set, and we kind of sat down and I just started writing stuff in that speech, because it was important that there's a speech at the end of the movie where it could sound, the script felt a little like bombastic or like self-righteous, or there was a little bit of it sounded like a movie. I mean, it was a movie moment, but it wasn't living in my mouth that I just wanted it to be a little bit more natural. I wanted to connect to it. I wasn't connecting to it. I guess that's the best way of saying it. And so we wrote that, and I started writing things on Die Hard, because the way they write those Die Hard movies is really just like, or at least it was, the thing they're most concerned about is obviously the stunts. And so, you know, they come up with the stunts and then they kind of like fill in the rest. They fill in all the parts that to get to the stunts. And so I got the sense that like there was a lot of freedom on these jobs to write. And Christian and I like have a very similar sense of humor. And so we thought, well, let's just start, let's write our own thing. And that was like a 10-year journey. We'd write pilots. Occasionally we'd sell them. We never got to make them. Then we started writing our own. We wrote a web series that we were really proud of called The Real Stephen Blatt.
Yeah.
And it was about a kid who gets his a cell phone and just becomes totally corrupted by it. And that was such an enjoyable experience. And, you know, we got such good feedback, and Amazon ended up putting it on their platform. And Ben Stiller called us in for a meeting, you know, wanted to do a script of ours. So it led, we were encouraged. We were, it gave us a lot of encouragement and enough so that we felt like we could try to write and direct a feature. And I love ghost tours. I love going to a southern, you know, like an antebellum city and going on one of those ghost tours.
Yep.
And so we had this idea then for a ghost on this tour to haunt the tour guide, basically, to haunt the woman who's playing her. And really, we just wanted to make a buddy comedy, because those were our favorite types of movies. And so we kind of made a ghost movie as a buddy comedy.
Yeah. I'm curious about one detail of a story you told about a bizarre incident that you had like more than 10 years ago when you were filming a movie and you were temporarily abducted and you jumped out of a car, which resulted in lingering nerve damage. First of all, what's the lingering physical effects that you deal with?
Well, it's not, I couldn't really show you. It's more of just, I have no real feeling in my shin,
oh.
in my right
wow.
shin. I have a little bit of scarring from
you
it.
You jumped out of a car.
Well, yes, it's one of those stories. First of all, it's a long story, but that is what happened. I mean, I know it's a crazy, it's one of those stories you can't really nutshell. You know, it's like, well, yeah, I smoked some stuff that turned out not to be weed, and these guys.
You met some people at a bar in a town in Michigan because you were filming a movie there, and they.
Yeah, I was filming.
It was just random people, and you were hanging out with them, and they basically drugged you surreptitiously.
Yeah. Yes, and all of the questions that anybody listening to this has, I can answer them. It would just take a long time. Like, what were you doing with these people? Why did they give you this drug? Why did you smoke it? Surprisingly, there are good answers to all of these. But yes, the net result was that I felt like my life was in danger. And yeah. I don't mean to be glib about it. I've done a lot of work. You know, it was definitely a traumatic experience. Sure. But I'm just laughing because it's funny to talk about without actually saying the story. But I did. Yes, Guy, I was like incapacitated. I told the story to a guy in private security, and he thinks it was probably PCPs that instead of weed, it was laced with PCP. It was laced with something that made my mind wild and my body shut down. Yeah. So I jumped out of this car and it was an experience that like, I didn't really talk about it for a long time. Shortly after it happened, I told Dax Shepard, not on his show. He didn't have a podcast then. This was years ago. And I would tell people that I like felt safe with, but I certainly never talked about it publicly. And I think I realized because there was like a lot of shame in it. And but speaking about it publicly actually did help.
What I remember about that story is that there was a threat by these people who had taken you that they were going to film you and sell it to a tabloid, yeah. Like a TMZ type. And
yes, that's right.
And you have remarkable. I mean, you mentioned like hanging out with Lindsay Lohan in your early 20s, and maybe there were photos taken, and people said, "Oh, who's this guy?" But you've remarkably managed to stay out of that world. I mean, it's not a secret that your partner is Kate Bosworth, another well-known actor. How do you stay out of that part of living as a public figure?
Well, that's interesting, Guy. I think it's easy, actually. I think it's for example, I'm in a pretty remote town in Massachusetts right now. There's no threat of. In fact, the first time we were photographed was at a restaurant called Giorgio Baldi, which is like. You couldn't be too surprised by photographers being out there. And it kind of comes with the territory. And it's basically you just have to know where to go and where not to go. And in terms of getting, you know, caught up in any of that, any gossip or anything, it's very easy to not read. I learned that in a relationship with an actress years ago where I just never looked at the stuff.
Yeah. How do you do that? How do you avoid doing that?
I'm pretty disciplined. I don't Google myself. I don't. If I'm on Instagram, I'm on it sparingly, you know. And it's because it's not real. I mean, it's all just chatter and people having opinions and like. And I have very thin skin, Guy. Like I take things personally. Hmm. So the few times I've broken down and I've learned the lesson. I've learned not to do it because I've done it. And I know that when you look and you absorb things and you read bad reviews, some people are stronger with that. I have a thicker skin than I did certainly when I started out, but it still affects me. And so I find the easiest way is to just totally avoid it.
Given all the different things you've done, you know, voice acting and animated films and stage and television and film and screenplays. Tell me what other projects you'd want to do. Like, I mean, you've made shorts for Funny or Die and web series and things like that. I mean, there are so many things that you've done and things that you can go back to and do again. What are some of the things that you, when you think, because you're a young guy, I mean, you've got your whole career ahead of you.
Wow.
What are the things that you would love to do?
I'd love to be a father. Mm-hmm. I'd really love to have kids. Mm-hmm. And I would love to, I'd love to get a cartoon in the New Yorker. That's a goal.
But you were a cartoonist as a kid. I didn't even mention that.
Yeah, I loved it. And So I've been, I submitted a few and I got some nice, some promising responses and enough to encourage me to maybe submit more.
All right.
So one day. That's what I hoped one day. And we really, my brother and I, we love doing the podcast. So we hope to keep doing that, but we really want to make a mockumentary. We love mockumentary style movies. And I love the Christopher Guest movies so much that we know so many funny people between us. So we're working on something. We'd really love to make our version of a mockumentary. And I miss doing theater. I'd love to get back out there. But I love writing. I don't know. I just want to kind of stay active. I love now that the world is opening up a little bit.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about the podcast because I forgot to ask you about that. You know, many years ago, I agreed to teach a class on audio at a college, at a very fancy, famous college. And it was actually awesome. It was about 12 years ago. It made me better at what I do when I started to talk about it, because I had to bring other like people in the industry into the class as guests, and I brought some really well-known people, and it was awesome to hear them and their process and their technique, and I could ask them questions. And you're doing that as a podcaster. You are basically doing a masterclass in acting and living and also learning how to become an interviewer. Now you've done 100 and 200 episodes or whatever. That must actually make you better at what you do, being able to talk to the people who do what you do as well.
Oh, I think so. I hope so, Guy. You see the next few movies I do and you might take issue with that. But it feels that way. It definitely feels like I've cultivated more of an appreciation, like I said, for getting to do what I do. But I guess the focal point has been on actors. But I'm curious about a lot of things, yeah. You know, the world. And so we've had a lot of different great guests on. I got to talk to Dr. Jane Goodall and Neil deGrasse Tyson and you know, people that I really admire. You had mentioned that incident in Michigan where I was jumped out of a car. I think since then, the long-term effect that had on me was like, I'm more reluctant to go into a bar. I used to love to go into a bar and just have a few drinks, start getting to know people. And I don't do that anymore. But I love people. I love talking, as you can hear.
Yeah.
I do love talking to people. And so it's just that has been such a joy. And getting to like catch up with friends. Sam Rockwell was on and Vince Vaughn and these people that Ben Stiller was just on. So people from my past that I don't, you know, who have families and lives and you don't really have occasion to have a nice in-depth conversation with, I get to nerd out on them.
When you think about the creative process and how you approach, how you've approached it and how you approach it, I mean, it's sort of an abstract idea. There's no process, right? It's things come and go, and sometimes you feel more creative and you lean into it, and sometimes you kind of are feeling less creative, but then you come back to it. Are there things that you, I mean, are there things that you sort of consciously try to do to stay creative or to stay engaged with the things that you do or want to do?
I try to enjoy my time off. You know, I try to be really present to anything, to whatever's happening. And meditation's helped a lot. And so when I then do commit to an acting project, I found that I'm more present to that, and I enjoy it more. I enjoy working now more than I ever have, and I think it's a combination of having like a real clarity about how lucky I am during the pandemic, not being able to do it for a little while, and knowing that if I weren't to do this, I'd struggle to make money, and I would I don't know what I would do. So I find now when whatever I invest in, I do it with more conviction than I used to. Sometimes I look back, Guy, at movies like some of the ones we were talking about, and the only regrets I have, it would be not being more present while it was happening. You know, staying out late the night before, partying, not being wholly present to this great opportunity. And so it's something that I take a lot more It's weird. I take the work more seriously, and I'm less invested in the outcome now and the trappings of it all.
That's actor Justin Long. By the way, even though Justin did Alvin and the Chipmunks back in 2007, just this past April, the rapper Lil Nas X tweeted that he really wanted to book Alvin and the Chipmunks for his birthday party, or he'd be sad. Well, he didn't get the Chipmunks, but Justin did record a birthday greeting for Lil Nas X, as you guessed it, Alvin. To see the show notes for this episode, go to thegreatcreators.com/long. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Hey, thanks so much for listening to our show this week. If you liked what you heard, we have one simple request. Please tell someone about it. Share a link, tweet, or post a story, and hashtag The Great Creators. You can find us on social media by searching The Great Creators. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and I'm on TikTok as Guy Raz. Spread the word, and thanks. This episode was produced by Avery Keatley and edited by Andrea Bruce, with help from Jeff Rogers. Thanks also to Elaine Coates, Kevin Leahy, Jenna Gedman, Nat Hoops, Michael May, and Daniel Shukin. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to The Great Creators from Built It Productions. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? Then check out the daily news podcast, The Best One Yet. Every morning on The Best One Yet, hosts Nick and Jack serve up to three of the most interesting business news stories and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies, you're going for that promotion at work, or you just want to know the trends before your friends, be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus, and for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business. Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.